if somebody on the street is falling, you do not say falling, falling, pain, pain. No. Vipassana is in that sense dry living. It's a pre-practice for life.
Good day. You're listening to European Buddha.
Hello and good morning to everyone out there, and welcome to the European Buddha podcast presented to you by the European Buddhist Union. In the last episode, we talked about the speed of everyday life and the unsatisfactory state of our mind, but also of our existence. Today, we want to follow up on that and turn to a specific practice, Vipassana. So, hello Emilia, how are you doing?
Hi Martin, I'm doing very good and excited to introduce today's guest. Henk Barenkret's background is in mathematical logic, which he studied in Utrecht University and received his PhD cum laude in the early 70s. Later same decade, he studied Zen meditation with Kopun Chino Roshi in California, and from 1977 to 2006, Vipassana meditation with Fra Metta Vihari in the Netherlands. During his amazing and rich career in mathematics, he's been awarded several times. As he both loves maths and is fond of meditation, he hasn't chosen either or, but kept them both very much alive. Warmly welcome, Henk. Let's go first to some definitions. What is Vipassana and where are its roots?
Vipassana came from the ancient Buddhists, and the most ancient that is still alive is the tradition of Theravada, the teachings of the elder. It aims at being more resilient to the stress of everyday life. The aim is to diminish suffering and even eradicate suffering. I would call it to eradicate the reactions to the stress of daily life. And this is done in two ways, concentration and insight, wisdom that we like to develop.
That sounds quite good. Can you maybe introduce us to a practice?
Yes, we can do it together. And we do not lean anymore to the chair, but we sit up. And we say, we still relax, but by sitting up, we relax in an active way. So let's do that. And from Zen, I learned you check your head, whether it's on top of your spine, because then you can sit in a better way. All right. We sit. And while sitting, we receive input through the senses. Maybe you feel how your legs are touching the chair, or maybe bench or pillow that you're sitting on. But then there is also hearing sounds. At the moment, mainly my voice. And slightly less input comes through the eyes. Even if you have them closed, some light will fall through them, through the eyelids. So please sit and observe through what sense most input is coming. And then we observe that there are thoughts. Thoughts are also considered as input through a sense, not through a bodily sense, but through the mind. And attention jumps from one sense to the other. And sometimes it stays with one sense, examining parts of the input of that sense. Attention has the function of scanning the environment, including our inner environment. Not only attention scans like a radar, we also can direct it. So let us now invite attention to observe the breath. And we do this by observing the movements in our belly. Or if we breathe a little bit higher, we observe the movements in the breast, as we say, while having breast respiration. And we can observe the cycle of the breath from no breath. With inspiration, the belly or breast expands to its maximal point, and then we exhale, and the belly or breast falls. All this is called one cycle. Now please observe with care a full cycle, just one, and afterwards you can relax a bit more. So you start when you have exhaled, and you try to observe the very beginning of this cycle towards its maximal point, towards its final point. Let's do this. It then can happen that we are sidetracked, often by a thought, sometimes by some pain. And at that moment, attention doesn't remain on the breath, but will go to the thought or the pain. But this happens even without us realizing this. And then after a little while, we realize, oh, hey, I've been thinking for a while, forgetting to observe the breath. Now, this is quite normal. Do not think that you are not doing it well. Being distracted is part of the exercise. It's even part of the exercise. And when you recognize that you're doing something else, thinking or observing the pain, then you relax. It's all right. You re-smile, make an inner smile, and return to the breath and repeat. Repeat from the beginning. Let us do this. So let us observe carefully the cycles of breath until we get sidetracked and until we, in a relaxed, friendly way, we return and start again. Now, all this is basic exercise number one, including the being sidetracked and including the returning to the breath in a relaxed and friendly way. And I hope you could taste some of the fruits of this. Just a little exercise already bears some fruit. And then we can finish the exercise right now.
Thank you. It made me think right away that how beneficial it is to us. Why not do it every day or even twice a day? You could really get in touch with reality.
Yes, the reality of your life. Because your life is experienced through your senses. And sometimes we forget this.
Exactly.
Being more in the intellectual, in the thinking life.
Yeah, sometimes it's, you think your life like a movie. And with this exercise, it was really also in the body. And combining these two parts that sometimes we think are separate, mind and body.
I have to quote something right away. I'm not actually even remember who said it, but something that you, Martin, said reminded me of this quote was like, we think our thoughts, but we actually think our society's thoughts. So this kind of exercise, I could feel that something dropped really, and I came home.
And sometimes the exercise is described in the following way. Going from your narrative self to what your experiential self. But Vipassana wants to go one step further, going towards the non-self at first, in which we see that the self that we think we are, even through our senses, is also a kind of construction. Then we go to non-self. But then to live our life, we need self. So we get back to the self, but in a purified way. And then this can be called the state of beyond self.
I also have a quote from you, Hank, that might be a little bit confusing to someone who does not have the context. But still, I think it's a very good short quote. You said, to deal with banana is the essence of vipassana. And I think you were referring to our mechanism to identify. Can you elaborate a little bit on this?
So we did basic exercise one. There is only one more exercise, basic exercise two, which goes as follows. I can do it now without meditating. So you observe the rising and the falling of your belly. And after a while, again, you will be sidetracked. But this time you do not go back to your breathing. You observe to what it is that did sidetrack you. And we call this the visitor. Now there are small, medium, and large visitors. And most people have large-sized visitors. Most people have bananas. And the meditation tries to understand the mechanism, the structure of those bananas. For example, if there is fear, that's something in the mind. But fear is also in the body. So it's a coalition between the body, you feel some pressure here, and a mental factor. And when you can separate them, then the power of that banana is much weaker. You relax, and the banana may go away. And this is the main task in Vipassana meditation, to let go of your bananas.
And one key ability seems to me, the ability to observe. You were using this term several times, to observe. And I'm asking myself often, who is the observer? Mm. Do you have a clue?
Who is it that knows? The classical text says there is seeing, but no one that sees. There is thinking, but no one that thinks. There is doing, but no one that does. Why is this important? Not to identify with what we see, or what we think, or what we do. Because when we identify, we have the tendency to fix it. It must be done in this way. It must be for me, for my pleasure. And when we're capable of making this more loose, then we are in a more balanced life, sometimes taking it, sometimes letting it go. And to dissolve, to deconstruct your bananas, an important part consists of seeing through your identity. In fact, it is your identity that holds on to many things. And if we are willing and capable of letting this go, then those stubborn bananas will also go.
Can we go a bit back in the time? As your background is in mathematical logic, you got your PhD at the 70, am I right, in the Utrecht University. How did you get interested in the meditation? And what was it? It was at that time. No.
No. I was interested in high school already in meditation.
I see.
I had some experiences that could be called border experiences or maybe mystical experiences that were, in my case, at the same time, very blissful, but also contained a part of fear. You're standing there on the edge of being and non-being, and the being part is blissful, and the non-being part, at least at that time, felt as fearful. So I asked a teacher that I trusted, in fact, my mathematics teacher, I asked him, what could such experiences point at? What could be the meaning of those? And next to several extra books on mathematics, this time he gave me a book on existentialism. And then the existentialists, they pointed to the Buddhists. So through this experience and the book on existentialism, I came to Buddhism. And read many books about it during my high school days. And then when I was a postdoc in California in the beginning of the 70s, I was lucky to find a Japanese monk that was teaching meditation, and I could practice with him in a little zendo, a little meditation hall in Los Altos.
How did this affect your mathematical career?
It combined well, because with the meditation technique, one could say it, with the meditation practice better, one obtains some concentration, some calm. And that's a good ground intuition, both mathematical intuition as meditation intuition about body and mind. Actually, in mathematics, intuition is the most precious tool. It's more precious than rationality and calculation, because we need intuition to sense new results, new theorems. And then with your rational tool, you prove them or you calculate with them. But this intuition is precious. So both the concentration and the development of intuition were important here.
That's beautiful, because it was actually my follow-up question, that how did your mathematical studies affect the meditation? But you already answered that.
Yeah, to me, it seems to be very clear right now what to do, but I know that I will forget. I don't know, how about you, Amelia?
That's a very good reminder on this. Let's keep practicing. We fall and we rise, and that's life.
Thank you very much, Henk, for your very precise and way of introducing us to Vipassana. And it really helped me, your clear language, to just go into the focus and then let go.
It was also a nice thought that when we get hijacked, it gives us actually opportunity to come back, wake up, and smile.
Any last words, Henk, for our listeners after introducing the Vipassana practice, but also maybe coming from a retreat? You just mentioned that you're coming back from a retreat. Do you have any inspiration?
In the retreat, you learn how to defuse your bananas, because there can be an explosive load inside of the bananas. And when you defuse them, you are more relaxed, or you even can let them go fully. Then even more you're relaxed. And the final goal is that you eradicate the banana tree so that no new bananas can grow. That's liberation. Then when you come home after a retreat, how should we behave? If somebody on the street is falling, you do not say falling, pain. No, the health is there. So this is the first clear comprehension. Do what is suitable. But do not do what is too much. If a tree falls on a car, you cannot lift the tree to help the people inside. So you call the fire brigade. So Vipassana is in that sense dry living. It's a pre-practice for life.
Thank you so much.